From the studios of North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, here comes Indie Week for January 15th of 2020. Reading, as always, for a blind and print-impaired audience, I am John Fetterson. Also, as always, we thank our musical ensemble for their wonderful introduction. Mistake-free since at least 2005. Bravo. And now we begin with our voices section. This week's Chika Gujarati, a Raleigh-based writer and author of the Hello Namaste children's books. Resolve to be happy, she advises. I tried truly to write about something other than New Year's resolutions because it's so overdone. But I'm the type who gets excited for a plain old Monday because it's the start of a new week. The beginning of a new year, a new decade, is just too hard to resist. Apologies in advance to all those who don't share my passion for resolutions. I'm married to one of you, after all, so no offense taken, but I hope you'll read along and let me indulge in some of my grand plans for 2020. In my teens and 20s, I paid a lot of attention to goal-setting rituals. I wanted them to be realistic, measurable, and all the good stuff that experts say is necessary for success. Weeks would go by in perfect harmony until that first inevitable day when I couldn't keep up with the promise I'd made. That, followed by a few more skipped days, and then the eventual giving up. Because what's the point now? In a way, it was the sheer attainability of those goals that led to the demise of my good intentions. Not only did I stop going for that daily morning run, but because of it, I also somehow started skipping my weekly yoga class, my monthly book club, and everything else that I had resolved to do that year. To me, failing at just one thing was enough of a blow to throw off the entire equilibrium. Now, in my 30s and quickly approaching my 40s, I have a new perspective on goal setting. I have embraced the fact that I am an adult with shortfalls, one of which is not always being able to keep a promise. That life is so freaking busy with mundane yet necessary tasks that when given the choice, I don't want to add to it. My only requirement now for setting new resolutions is, will I enjoy it while it lasts? That being said, here's a sampling of some of my resolutions for the year 2020. Illustrate one short story book each week. Last year, I had resolved to do something similar, which was to draw one new picture a day. I made it to 46 consecutive days and unintentionally created a portfolio that I used throughout the rest of the year for work purposes. Practice French for 15 minutes a day. Last year's streak lasted 100 days. Pick one new fancy recipe to try each week. Take one picture a day of a task or a scenario that's not considered social media worthy. And once a week, visit a place I've never been before. With this list, I'm reaching for stars that no one doubts are reachable. My life depends on none of these, and this is precisely what I'm hoping will make me stick with them as long as possible. Removing the burden and guilt from the equation, as it turns out, can make the process of setting new resolutions more enjoyable. Give it a try. Even if you can spare just 10, 15, or 30 minutes for yourself each day, resolving to fill that time with something that you enjoy will most definitely lead to other good decisions for the rest of the day, week, month, and year. Here's to hoping that silliness, creativity, and fun guide you into a happier and healthier life in 2020. Happy New Year, and may the force be with you. And moving right across to the next page, we have this new section called 15 Minutes, and this is a brief interview, this time with Whit Baker, who's a brewmaster from Bond Brothers Beer Company. You taught high school chemistry at Durham School of the Arts before moving into the beer world. How did you make that transition? And Mr. Baker answers, I wasn't really into beer in college until I was 26 or 7. I basically geeked out on the nerd factor, the process of making beer. And then the first year of home brewing, I got my beer judge certification. Now I drink more beer than I did before, when I didn't like beer, but I'm still pretty much into drinking beer for the sake of flavor. Question: how did you go from being certified as a judge to home brewing and to founding Bond Brothers to Ancillary to all of those other things you're doing? I just think about beer. I'm pretty much obsessed with beer. If you go to a new city and you drink a beer you haven't had before, where does your brain go? To the chemical processes behind what you're drinking? At this point, yes. But it's one of those things where if you think about it so much, you take different pathways. Now, I think about it more like a chef. You told me that light beers sell a lot better than dark beers. Yeah, generally. People are kind of conditioned at this point. IPA is craft beer, right? Until you get to be a little more of a nerd, or until you start going to a tap room and asking what everyone else wants to drink or what's their favorite. Everybody wants a hazy IPA, clear IPA, or lager. I don't know specifically why. I wish it was different. I think that dark beers, you know, the malts, give them more complexity. I personally know that my least favorite thing to do is to dry hop a beer. And at the bottom of this page, Jeffrey Bielman, the editor-in-chief, writes, the good, the bad, and the awful. He gives one in each category, and the good today is the Daily Tar Heel. The Daily Tar Heel did not do the work of a student newspaper last week. The Daily Tar Heel did the work of a first-rate major metro newspaper, out-hustling every media outlet in the region on one of the Triangle's biggest stories. First, its parent company sued the UNC system and Board of Governors for allegedly violating the state's open meetings law by secretly negotiating with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. A few days later, the DTH released a blockbuster report showing that the SCV may be violating state and federal tax laws. And for the bad, Sylvia Hatchell. It's been a rough year for Sylvia Hatchell, the long-tenured and hugely successful former coach of the UNC's women's basketball team. In April, she resigned after an independent investigation found she'd made racially insensitive remarks and forced some players to play injured. Then on Friday, she was charged with misdemeanor death by vehicle and a moving violation after Durham police say she struck an 89-year-old woman with her car while making a slow left turn outside of a fitness center. And awful. Sons of Confederate Veterans. As good a week as the DTH had, the SCV had an awful one. The lawsuit is bad enough. If the paper wins, a non-zero possibility, the settlement could be tossed. The paper's reporting is worse. Fees paid to an SCV cavalry were routed via cash or personal check to the state's SCV legislative officer, Bill Starnes, who then funneled that money into the SCV's PAC. That seems to be illegal in two ways. First, the funds paid to Starnes, tens of thousands of dollars, apparently weren't being tracked, as nonprofits are required to do. Second, as a 501c3, the Sons of Confederate Veterans simply isn't allowed to control a political action committee, as appears to be the case here. Moving past a one-page timeline about Durham and tobacco, we'll go to this next feature, A Week in the Life. Here's what happened since last week's Indy. On the 7th of January, the Raleigh City Council amended its rules of decorum to allow residents to address council members and city staffers by name. The Chinese company Yihang conducted the first public demonstration of a pilotless air taxi at the State Highway Patrol's test track south of Raleigh, because the rich obviously need more toys. State Superintendent Mark Johnson told school districts that the Department of Public Instruction had made a $928,000 emergency purchase of iStation, a controversial computer program that tests children's reading ability, after a judge blocked iStation from getting a new contract. On the 8th, the parent company of the Daily Tar Heel sued the UNC's Board of Governors for violating the state's open meeting laws. We've read about that. And 2019, it was reported, was the North Carolina's hottest year on record. Next day, on the 9th, the state office of the medical examiner said the three recent infant deaths at McDougal Terrace did not stem from carbon monoxide poisoning. The office did not say what the causes of death were. And according to Durham police, the city saw 37 criminal homicides in 2019, up from 32, but down from 42 in 2016. Then we have the 10th. The Daily Tar Heel reported North Carolina Division of Sons of Confederate Veterans has violated tax laws. Next, Republicans in the General Assembly sought an emergency stay of a federal judge's injunction of the state's voter ID law, arguing it would cause irreparable harm to let people vote without showing identification in the March primary. And the state's chief procurement officer said the state might reject Superintendent Johnson's emergency purchase of iStation because the DPI has not provided adequate justification. Then we have Tom Steyer on the 11th. A hedge fund manager with an estimated $1.6 billion visited McDougal Terrace. We'll hear more about that. And said conditions there reveal cruelty to the poor. Steyer has so far spent at least $119 million to garner about 2% in national polling. 9 days after Beer Study announced that Al's Burger Shack would be part of its Durham expansion, the bottle shop said on Facebook that it was no longer in business with Al Bowers. The news came after Al's filed for bankruptcy. And then finally, the Durham Democrats on the 12th nominated former State Representative Mickey Michaud Jr. to replace Senator Floyd McKissick, who resigned, to take a position on the Utilities Commission. And here's Tomasi McDonald's column concerning Tom Steyer's in Durham. Democratic presidential candidate and billionaire hedge fund manager Tom Steyer spent Saturday afternoon at McDougal Terrace. Brittany Buss is one of the more than 300 McDougal Terrace residents who have been relocated to an area hotel because of the public health issues identified in the neighborhood, including carbon monoxide, mold, lead paint, and potentially contaminated water due to pervasive sewage problems. Steyer and Buss come from very different worlds, but they were talking the same language about the issues that have beset the city's largest and oldest public housing complex. The federal government has given up its responsibility to deal with affordable housing across the country, Steyer said, after visiting an apartment at Building 51B and pulling a black T-shirt over his blue button-down dress shirt and tartan necktie. The T read, 51B Mac United. And he quotes, "They've done it for decades and it has to end. As you can see, we have deteriorating and inadequate public housing and affordable housing across this country. We've got to rebuild it. Counting on the market to solve this problem and have the government absolve itself of its actual responsibility hasn't worked. This is the proof." Minutes before, Buss stood in front of a microphone inside the auditorium at Burton Elementary and spoke powerfully about living in the MAC to several hundred fellow residents, activists, supporters, and elected officials who had come for updates. In the last 2 months, three infants had died in the complex under mysterious circumstances. The state medical examiner has ruled out carbon monoxide as the cause of death, but has not said what killed them. Buss says she's worried about the mold, maintenance workers who paint over the lead-based paint on the walls, and sewage she fears has leaked into residents' drinking water. "Carbon monoxide is in the air they breathe," she said, "affecting residents' behavior and perhaps responsible for much of the anger and violence in the community." "It's deeper than this," Buss said of the updates provided earlier by Anthony Scott, Durham Housing Authority's chief executive officer, and other officials. "This is bigger than McDougal Terrace. This is happening on a global level. Why are y'all doing this to us? This is so, so deep. Why do you think people in McDougal Terrace are killing each other? It's the gas. It's the gas." While carbon monoxide is not typically linked to violent behavior, exposure to lead in childhood has been. Even so, Buss's observations struck a deep chord with the capacity crowd, and as the residents stood cheering, an elderly resident on the front of the auditorium was so overcome that she fainted. Before Buss spoke, Mayor Steve Shule said Sunday morning's meetings at Burton was not an assembly any of us wanted to have. What is happening with the McDougal Terrace relocation is a terrible thing, Shule said, and I apologize. I'm sorry you're going through this. Shule praised the residents for their spirit, dignity, and support for one another after having their lives upended. Saturday marked the end of a week in which DHA's officials relocated 270 households in McDougal to 12 area hotels while the agency inspected 243 apartments. On Saturday, Scott said inspectors discovered 35 furnaces or heaters, 34 water heaters, and 133 cooking stoves that were emitting carbon monoxide. In some instances, they found all three in one apartment. And there are other issues inspectors found as well, including leaking gas valves and terracotta pipes in the flues. Scott said the DHA is putting together a strategy and reviewing options that include replacing gas-fueled appliances with electric ones. He added that the agency will spend this week obtaining estimates for repairs and begin mold inspections. Scott also promised to increase security after several residents reported break-ins at their apartments while they have been at hotels. We're not patching up the problem, Scott said. We're trying to solve the problem. It's about fixing the problems, not patching up the holes. Like Steyer and Buss, Scott expressed frustration over federal officials' decades-long inaction. This is a national issue, he said. The federal government has to do a better job. Minutes after that meeting ended, Steyer arrived at the MAC after attending a luncheon at nearby NC Central. The candidate, who is worth an estimated $1.6 billion, was accompanied by County Commissioner candidate John Rooks, who persuaded him to visit the complex. I wanted him to have this experience, Rooks told Indy. Steyer's nearly two-hour visit included a walk down Ridgeway Street, where every few yards stood a location with an unspoken story. He walked past Building 41, where the Indy first reported about a corrupted manhole cover that had been leaking raw sewage for months, and where a stormwater pipe had been pouring raw sewage into a nearby creek. He strolled past the apartment that housed Bull City United, an initiative to reduce gang activities. He stopped briefly in front of Building 27, where a child died of sudden infant death syndrome in the 1990s. The building was boarded and has sat unoccupied since. Housing and race have always been at the epicenter of inequality in this country, Steyer said. He arrived at the intersection of Ridgeway and Wabash, where Building 7 has been boarded up for years. He walked a few feet down the sidewalk and visited the home of Ashley Kennedy, the president of the McDougal Terrace Residence Council, who lives across the street from where a young man was shot to death in November. This is not an unknown story, Steyer said. This is a story about failure across the board. So that means housing, for sure. But it's also about safety, poisoning, and there's no way to look at this and not take race into account. The housing bond Durham voters approved in November allocates almost $60 million to renovate several DHA properties, including the MAC, over the next 5 years. So far, Steyer has spent nearly $120 million on advertising in his presidential campaign. Nationally, he is polling at about 2%. Next, from Raleigh, Lee Tauss's column, Is Bigger Better? The Raleigh City Council has had 8 members since 1973, which also happens to be the first and last time Raleigh had a black mayor, Clarence Leitner. Since then, the city's population has almost quadrupled, yet the structure of its government has remained virtually the same. That could soon change. Last week, the council instructed City Attorney Robin Tatum Curran to begin creating a study group to explore if and how the council structure should change. That could include increasing terms from 2 to 4 years, upping council members' pay, currently $17,400 for what's considered a part-time gig, and expanding the council's size. The move came at the urging of a coalition of residents that includes former News and Observer publisher Orage Quarles III, former Planning Commission Chairman Eric Braun, and former council candidate Ashton May Smith. Smith, who asked the city to form that study group during the city council's public comment period last week, told Indy, "These conversations have been going on for a long time. Raleigh has outgrown its current governance structure," Smith says. "I think for this particular council, there's more appetite to at least start the conversations than we've historically seen." While the council asked its staff for information on the matter in 2017, that memo is, quote, "protected under attorney-client privilege," according to Curran's office. It's unclear what was in the memo, but it's clear that nothing came of it. The new study group will examine what cities of similar size do in terms of council pay, size, and term length. Its purpose is primarily to collect data so the council can make a decision. Council member David Cox thinks the city should look into expanding the council's size. His district alone has over 90,000 residents. More council seats, be they at large or by divvying up the five existing districts, could encourage folks to run who otherwise couldn't. "Demographically, the city's changed a lot, and I think everyone is in agreement that the council doesn't really represent, at least demographically, the city's population," Cox said. "Not that increasing the number of members necessarily will fix that, but I think it gives a greater opportunity to allow that to happen." By design, most of the people who have been able to run for office have been independently wealthy and retired. They've also tended to be white. Increasing council members' pay might allow lower-income residents to run for office. Additionally, increasing term lengths to 4 years with staggered elections could create more consistency in city leadership while cutting down the time council members spend campaigning. The criticism is that serving under 2-year terms, you're governing 1 year and running for re-election the next, says Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. That's a governance issue. The conversation on expanding the number of council seats will likely have to wait until the census is completed later this year, Baldwin says. After that, the city will update its district lines to ensure the population is distributed evenly anyway. "We'll be looking at the districts again this year because, let's face it, a lot has changed in Raleigh in the last 10 years, Baldwin says. She hopes the study group can be appointed within the next 60 days and complete its work by the end of summer. And now Jeffrey Billman's cover article, Without a Trace. This story contains a description of an alleged sexual assault. 3 years after it happened, after her life was upended, Alia Palmer is still looking for something that feels like justice. She's spoken out about that night, January 21st, 2017, in a party in an apartment near Fort Bragg, about the young man who handed her shots, about how she flirted and then made out with an Army combat medic, about how he pulled her into a bathroom to have sex. She's been open, too, about what she says happened next, about how the man, whom she identifies in court documents as Nicholas Savoy, became aggressive, how he wedged her against the sink so she couldn't move, how he pulled her hair so hard that clumps came out of her scalp, how he tried but failed to have anal sex with her, how she pleaded with him to stop but he wouldn't stop. Pieces of the night are a blur, but some things she remembers clearly. Savoy's friends guarding the bathroom door, sneaking their phones underneath the door to take pictures, seeing their cameras flashing in the darkness, finally escaping almost 3 hours later when Savoy stopped to get water. The next day, Palmer went to the Fayetteville police and told them she'd been raped. Months later, 4 of Savoy's friends faced charges related to the images they'd taken and shared, but Savoy was never arrested. Palmer learned from a reporter about a 40-year-old state Supreme Court decision that said consent could not be withdrawn once it was given. North Carolina was the last state with such an anachronistic law on the books. In 1993, it had been the last state to outlaw marital rape. Palmer was angry. She told her story to anyone who would listen: The Guardian, Vice, the Fayetteville Observer, NBC News. Her advocacy paid off. Her story and similar stories from other women forced state lawmakers to act. Last Halloween, the General Assembly closed the so-called right to finish loophole. But for Palmer, it wasn't enough. It wasn't justice. Savoy would never face a jury. Palmer was a freshman at NC State in 2017, an 18-year-old on a full ride, the first member of her immediate family to go to college. She'd graduated first in her class at Olympic High School in Charlotte. She was studying animal sciences. She had her whole life in front of her, but all of that changed. She became withdrawn and depressed, began using drugs and drinking more. She couldn't focus. Within months, she dropped out, her scholarship gone. She had no hope of going back. Instead of graduating last month, as she'd planned, she saw her former classmates post their graduation pictures on Facebook. She has a good job working full-time in a vet clinic, she says, but this isn't where she imagined herself 5 years ago. Last week, Palmer set out to get the only justice available to her. She filed a lawsuit in Wake County Superior Court suing Savoy and his four Army buddies for assault and battery, false imprisonment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, invasion of privacy, or in legal terms, intrusion upon seclusion, and conspiracy. But she didn't stop there. In something of a novel legal twist, Palmer also sued the parent companies of the hugely popular apps Tinder and Snapchat. The complaint alleges that Snapchat invaded her privacy and exploited pornographic images of her without her consent, and says both Tinder and Snapchat have fundamental defects in their design, and, quote, acted in a willful, wanton, malicious, oppressive, and grossly negligent manner in conscious disregard of the rights and safety of Palmer and others. The crux of the argument is that Snapchat provides a platform in which users can share illicit and degrading images with impunity, while Tinder allegedly allows bad actors to erase messages and other potentially incriminating information. As they've become bigger and more powerful, Internet giants have faced calls for government regulation. Facebook, for instance, has come under fire for violating users' privacy and for its hands-off approach to political advertising. Google mines almost every facet of your online presence with little or no regulation, and then sells that information to advertisers. Tinder and Snapchat are ephemeral by design, and that's helped them gain millions of users and earn billions of dollars. With that success, Palmer argues, should come responsibility. At the very least, she says, those companies should maintain and make available records that allow law enforcement to help victims of harassment, sexual assault, and revenge porn. Right now, the complaint alleges they don't. When people use those platforms, they're not thinking about, well, what happens if I get assaulted or this happens to me? Will there be evidence? Palmer says, we're not thinking about that. There's a bunch of college-age, even high school-age people using that stuff, and that's just not what our first thought is. People who are young have the mentality that everyone is good. Maybe it's naive, but I feel like young people should be allowed to feel like that because it doesn't feel good having to feel like everyone is bad. Well, Palmer wasn't into the pulsing, sweaty, 100-person-in-a-keg strand frat house parties she found around NC State. She liked more low-key hangs, which is what sometimes drew her and her friends to Fayetteville on weekends. Get-togethers around Fort Bragg tended to be more laid back, and the drive wasn't that far, just about an hour or so. She downloaded Tinder in 2016 toward the end of her senior year in high school. That April, Tinder launched Tinder Social, which, instead of matching individuals, matched groups of people for meetups. They discontinued Social in August of 2017. Palmer and her friends used it. That's how they were paired with Savoy and his friends. The Army guys invited them to the party. Palmer's friend Kennedy had a prior commitment, another party on the base itself a few minutes away, but Palmer agreed to go. Savoy met her outside. They hit it off. Palmer didn't know much about them, just their pictures, the names they'd given on their Tinder account, and they said they were soldiers. But other than their insistence that she drink, she had two shots and no more. Nothing seemed off. Savoy didn't give off weird vibes. If he had, Palmer says, she wouldn't have kissed him, let alone consented to sex. Nothing was wrong until the sex turns violent, she says. Parenthetically now, Palmer's lawsuit says Savoy was a medic with 82nd Airborne. It's not clear whether Savoy is still in the Army. When Indy called the Wisconsin number listed for Savoy, a woman who identified herself as his mother answered and said, I'm not giving you any information. My son was not charged with anything, and if his name shows anywhere being published, we will go after you. This girl has been trying to go after him, but he couldn't be charged. I spoke with a police officer who is investigating, and he told me there was nothing. Her story was not corroborated. She then hung up. When she left the bathroom nearly 3 hours later, Palmer says her first thought was to get Savoy's friends to delete the photos she knew they'd taken. I didn't want that stuff out there, she says. You know, anyone can guess that's a college-aged dude with pictures and videos, so it's not going to keep it to themselves, so I knew they were going to spread them. And obviously I'm in college. It could easily get back to campus. I knew other people that were on base, so it just wasn't something that I wanted to happen. They denied the photos existed. By this point, nearly 2 a.m., there were no women left at the apartment. She called Kennedy, who was at a party a few minutes away, and told her what happened. While she was on the phone, she says the men in the apartment yelled and swore at her and told her she was lying. They refused to let her get her shoes. They told her to get out of the apartment. She left. Kennedy came to pick her up. A few days later, Kennedy went back for her shoes. She was told they'd been thrown over the balcony. She found them and found that someone had defecated in them. The next morning, Kennedy sent her a text message asking if she'd seen what the guys had posted in the Tinder social group chat. Palmer says she opened it and saw messages boasting about the photos and videos they'd taken. She says she was about to take a screenshot of the messages, but they vanished. The men unmatched from the group, and when they did, the messages went with them. When she went to the police, they seemed sympathetic, Palmer says. By March, she says, they told her they were planning to arrest Savoy for rape, but months passed, and nothing happened. In May, she called to see what was going on and was told the district attorney wasn't going to pursue rape charges. But the detective said they had interviewed Savoy's friends, and one of them confessed to sharing the images they'd taken with the others on Snapchat and through text messages. According to the lawsuit, the police also told Palmer that they searched the men's phones and found evidence that several of them had taken photos or videos or had shared them on Snapchat. Like Tinder, Palmer's lawsuit says Snapchat does not keep a record or copy of photos and videos sent between users. Snaps are erased after 10 seconds. Unopened snaps disappear after 30 days, and once they're gone for good. The lawsuit says this operational feature makes it exceedingly difficult for law enforcement to verify when and by whom illicit Snapchat content is sent, because establishing probable cause and obtaining a lawful warrant almost always requires more time. It's not clear what the police's evidence entailed, though it's possible the men saved screenshots of the snaps. In June of 2017, according to the lawsuit, the police arrested Savoy's four friends, Jeffrey Creech, John Christopher Nagy, Samuel Mazariegos, and Anthony Johnson, for possession of a photographic image from peeping. Nagy and Mazariegos were also charged with felony secret peeping, while Creech was charged with obstruction of justice for deleting images that Nagy sent him. The charges against Johnson were dismissed in the interest of justice in November 2018, Cumberland County records show. The charges against Nagy and Mazariegos were dismissed after they completed the terms of a plea deal. For Nagy, 12 months of unsupervised probation and 48 hours of community service. For Mazariegos, 12 months of unsupervised probation and $60 in restitution. No records of the charges against Creech exist. Tinder and Snapchat did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. As far as Robbie Jessup knows, this might be the first case of its kind against the social media giants, almost certainly in North Carolina. Palmer's lawyer, who also brought lawsuits related to alleged sexual abuse against the Montessori School of Raleigh and Duke University over its now shuttered Camp Kaleidoscope, admits that he's treading new ground, but he thinks it's important ground to tread. Disappearing evidence is a symptom of a larger problem, he says. Snapchat and Tinder became profitable by embracing a Wild West mentality that puts people at risk. Media reports are often hyperbolic when discussing Snapchat, especially when it comes to concerns about teenage sexting and child predators and revenge porn. The reality is most people don't use Snapchat to sext, and certainly not for more odious purposes. But many researchers believe Snapchat has fueled a rise in sexting, thanks to the perceived inconsequentiality of sending the images and videos. Even after all, if they disappear, even for Snapchat servers in 10 seconds, wouldn't that assure users they won't end up all over the internet? Of course, technology being what it is, there are workarounds. Screenshots, obviously. But more sophisticated tools for saving videos, too. And the record of what was sent vanishes. I think the Snapchat element, how it's designed, is something that needs to be addressed, Jessup says. They're doing something different than other social media platforms, something more nefarious to get eyeballs. Tinder, meanwhile, is owned by Match, the company behind Match.com, one of the early internet dating sites. Match.com screens its paying users to ensure they are not registered sex offenders, but it does not screen users on Tinder, Plenty of Fish, or OkCupid, which Match also owns. An investigation by Columbia Journalism Investigations and ProPublica published in December analyzed 157 sexual assaults in which the victim met the assailant through a dating app, usually one owned by Match. Match.com had no cases in which a person was assaulted by a sex offender. Match's other sites did. Match told Columbia Journalism Investigations that running background checks would be cost prohibitive and counterproductive. Sex offenders could simply give a false name. For that reason, announcing background checks might give users a false sense of security. Match urged CJI to look at the numbers in context. A relatively small amount of the tens of millions of people using one of our dating services have fallen victim to criminal activity by predators. But Match.com takes a step that can assist police if something goes wrong. It saves messages between users. It's unclear whether Match does the same for Tinder. In the CJI report, when a sexual assault victim sought Tinder messages to help prove her case, the company never responded. Authorities declined to press charges, and she soon saw her assailant back on the app. Match has never modified Tinder's design to save copies of a user's messages in the way that makes them more easily accessible to victims of sexual assault and or to law enforcement, the complaint alleges. Jessup says Match views Tinder as a, quote, secretive hookup platform where they don't want to have evidence of what people are saying to each other, close quote. This is especially problematic, he continues, because so many of Tinder's users are young. Almost 40% are between the ages of 16 and 24. To prevail in court, Jessup needs to get around what's known as CDA 230. In 1996, Congress passed the Communications Decency Act, which contains a provision, Section 230, that grants immunity to online hosts for user-generated content. It was crafted to protect the nascent Internet from overregulation, and companies including Match and Snapchat have used it as a defense against state and federal lawsuits, including from victims of sexual assault. In the lawsuit, Jessup is employing a different legal strategy. He's not going after the content. He's arguing the products themselves are defective. In addition, the lawsuit says Tinder and Snapchat inflicted emotional distress not when the content was posted, but when they allowed it to be deleted. Whether it will work remains to be seen. Alaya Palmer doesn't expect to turn the corner and suddenly find a happy ending. I've always been the person in life that tries to stay strong through a lot of things, she says, her voice breaking. But today the reality is that I lost school. School's out of the question. I had a full ride, and I can't go back without it. I can't afford to. I've had to support myself since I was 17. She has a good job now, but this wasn't where she thought she'd end up. She's hard on herself. She feels like she's failed, although she acknowledges that the world failed her. She's contemplated suicide. She's lost friends and become distant from her family. She feels alone. And, yes, her lawsuit will seek damages, but she makes a point of saying that it's not about money. It's just the only avenue she has left. I never went into this about money, Palmer says. I didn't make any of those things up for money. Did I have money? No. Do I still have money? Absolutely not. But at the end of the day, my life got destroyed. It got destroyed. And if the only way they can be held responsible for this is financially, then so be it, because I think it's extremely unfair for my life to go into complete turmoil and for them to keep living their lives. Additional reporting for that article was by Lee Taus. Our next long-form article by John Elliston, the FBI's main Klan man. Newly declassified documents show how an infamous North Carolina KKK leader made a fortune from the feds before being exposed as a snitch. Some state secrets come out in dribs and drabs, becoming more damning along the way. Case in point, it's long been known that the Federal Bureau of Investigation funded and gathered intelligence from George Dorsett, the late Greensboro resident, who held key positions in the state and national branches of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1960s. What's new are details about how Dorsett first reaped a financial windfall and then found himself exposed as a government snitch, and how backroom firestorms erupted at the FBI when congressional investigators revealed the broad brushes of that arrangement. The revelations come courtesy of the JFK Records Act, which mandated that remaining secret documents potentially related to President Kennedy's 1963 assassination should be made public unless their release could still compromise national security or the privacy of living individuals. Large remaining batches were unveiled in 2017 and 2018, and while none provided a smoking gun on that assassination, some offered new information about right-wing extremists who would have been happy to see Kennedy dead. In North Carolina, Dorsett, described in FBI documents as a top-tier informant, was certainly one of those, a fervent white supremacist with a flair for public relations and subterfuge. Dorsett served as a kind of spiritual official, fundraiser, and rouser for the Klan during its most violent years. Amid the trove of secrets in the JFK files, Dorsett's case stands out for its revelations about how closely the FBI skirted the line when both undermining and supporting Klan factions, at a time when the KKK's biggest statewide membership was in North Carolina. What's more, they document the panic that set in at the Bureau's highest level when the FBI's decade-long relationship with Dorsett started to go public. That all came out in the newspaper, noted Dargan Frierson, the late FBI agent who handled and befriended Dorsett, in a 1990 oral history for UNC Greensboro's archival project, Civil Rights Greensboro. The FBI was horrified when it happened. At the time, though, it didn't all come out, and the declassified files offer significant reminders about why the Bureau was intent on keeping details about its unholy alliance with Dorsett under wraps. In 1959, the Klan presence in North Carolina was fractured and reeling from internal disputes and law enforcement crackdowns, with its membership estimated to have dwindled to as little as 150, according to State Bureau of Investigation's records at the time. But the rise of the civil rights movement was on the horizon, and with it, an explosion of Klan mobilization was coming. That year, the FBI recruited a man who would prove to be one of its most valuable assets within the Klan. A house painter by trade, Dorsett had already served in ministerial and leadership roles in prominent Klan organizations during the 1950s, and his star was ascending. In the 1960s, he would serve as the Imperial Klud, or national chaplain of the Alabama-based United Klans of America, the ranks of which grew to more than 10,000 in North Carolina. He also held other top state and national posts and later formed his own Klan offshoot. Throughout this period, the FBI made regular payments to Dorsett as a confidential informant, placing considerable value on his info and looking the other way when he rallied the Klan faithful. Dorsett was one heck of a speaker and could really fire up a crowd, his FBI handler Frierson recalled in the oral history. He could portray himself as one of them, and he would tell me everything that was going on. So sure, he'd made some fiery speeches, no question about it. But if he hadn't, he would have been worthless. There's nothing to indicate, however, that Dorsett wasn't one of them, a true believer in the Klan's mission, and he didn't shy away from fostering racial terrorism. at an August 1966 rally that packed Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium and drew public protest. He said, "We're sitting on a powder keg. You don't know what I'll do before I leave, and you don't know what you'll do. We don't believe in violence, and we're not going to have violence if we have to kill every N-word in America." It was for remarks like these, along with his fundraising and organizing for the Klan, that a congressional subpoena compelled Dorsett to Washington, D.C. the previous year to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. In that appearance, Dorsett was uncharacteristically tight-lipped, refusing to answer questions or provide documents. The committee staffers nevertheless laid out a detailed case that Dorsett was an influential minister of hate. But they had no idea that behind his stony silence was an even bigger secret that led all the way to the FBI. Throughout the South, the FBI staged a clandestine campaign to infiltrate, disrupt, and at times effectively control various Klan groups. That was strikingly the case in North Carolina, as sociologist David Cunningham documented in his book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. The FBI's objective, Cunningham wrote, was to covertly, quote, attack the Klan's most obvious vulnerabilities, the simmering suspicion that leaders exploited the membership financially, certain members' limited employment prospects, and the fact that more than a few wives of Klansmen felt that weekly Clavern, local chapter meetings, and dark of night missions provided ruses for adulterous activities. Unquote. The weapons of choice were rumor campaigns, anonymous mailings, and other steps to breed dissension in the ranks, he noted, and, as with all bureau programs, secrecy would be a priority. The FBI's biggest secret in North Carolina was its long-running relationship with Dorsett. One of the recently declassified memos written in February 1976 reveals just how much the bureau rewarded the Klan organizer. Dorsett was on the bureau's payroll from January 1959 to October of 1970, according to one of the FBI memos. The payments totaled $26,266, the equivalent of more than $200,000 today when adjusted for inflation. Roughly two-thirds of the payment was for services provided, with the remainder covering unspecified expenses. The memo added, an analysis of these payments at FBI headquarters reveals Dorsett was paid on a cash-on-delivery basis, and that these payments were commensurate with the information he furnished. Even as he rallied the state's most hardcore racist, Dorsett helped the FBI destabilize North Carolina's large UKA contingent by exacerbating tensions among the group's leaders. Banished from the UKA in 1967, Dorsett quickly founded a rival faction, the Confederate Knights of the KKK, with a big assist from his FBI handler, Frierson, who helped draft the group's first manifesto and passed Dorsett still more cash. Internally, the FBI viewed its work helping to found a Klan group as a major accomplishment. We utilized this opposing Klan organization through Dorsett as a means of causing confusion and dissension within the Klan, an FBI report later noted. A total of 44 chapters of the CKKKK were chartered. However, all of them did not become effective operating chapters. By 1970, both the UKA and Dorsett's organization were in tatters, and the Klan's heyday in North Carolina drew to a close, even as the fires it stoked would spark again just a few years later. Dorsett, quote, was discontinued as an informant when his activity in the Klan ceased, at which time his relationship with the Bureau continued to be excellent, the FBI concluded. His handler would recall Dorsett as the number one Klan informer in the country. Even with no substantial Klan contingent to back or lead, Dorsett remained a committed white supremacist orator, albeit an ever more marginal one, until he died in Greensboro in 2008 at age 90. He might have faded into the history books relatively quickly had inquisitive members of Congress not sniffed out his FBI ties. The exposure came courtesy of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, also known as the Church Committee, which set off political fireworks with its revelations of decades of crime and cover-ups by the CIA, FBI, and other secretive agencies. Among the operations it probed were the FBI's counterintelligence programs, COINTELPRO, as they're often known, against dissidents, ranging from the New Left to the Black Panthers to white hate groups like the Klan. Committee staffers pieced together enough information from selectively provided FBI files to identify Dorsett as a major informant, and word leaked to national newspapers in December of 1975. The accounts proved little detail about Dorsett's working relationship with the FBI, but the cat was clawing its way out of the bag. The late Senator Robert Morgan, a North Carolina Democrat, was among the committee members shocked by the FBI-KKK connection. In an April 1976 speech at Wake Forest University's Law Day observance, Morgan publicly confirmed Dorsett's FBI relationship, adding additional details and calling the arrangement part of a pattern of immoral and illegal activity by the FBI. Already stung by the December leak, the FBI was now apoplectic. The Senate committee and Morgan had committed a most serious breach of the confidentiality the Bureau had expected when sharing its secret files with lawmakers. Dorsett had not previously been exposed as an informant, and he continued to deny his role during brief public remarks that were increasingly met with skepticism. Promptly interviewed by the FBI, Dorsett told agents that he now feared for his life and that the revelations had caused great consternation among his close friends and members of his family, the Bureau noted. He has received harassing phone calls. During one of these calls, a caller stated, "Tell that pimp to get his casket ready." The FBI's leadership fired off a series of memos to the church committee demanding informers not be further identified and warning of the gravity of outing Dorsett. Now, though the relationship was now effectively public information, in the end, the committee's public report summarized the matter without naming the once influential Klansman, but by then George Dorsett and the FBI's secret was out. David Cunningham interviewed Dorsett late in life. The infamous informer didn't seem particularly regretful. "What struck me was his retrospective view that the FBI was working for him," Cunningham recalled in remarks to his book's publisher in 2013, which isn't entirely inaccurate if you consider how he was able to protect his role as the KKK's most successful fundraiser while on the Bureau's payroll. And fairly close to the end, I have time to read a music article by Dan Ruccia from Indie Week columns on music. We don't get to read too many of those. This is called American Tumult. To paraphrase another New Englander, Charles Ives' music contains multitudes. It often goes without saying that a composer was influenced by a musical childhood. But it has to be said of Charles Ives, for whom the unruly musical welter of late 19th century New England, a mess of Protestant hymns, marches, other band music, camp songs, rags, patriotic tunes, and classical music played in parlors with both foundation and firmament. Its echoes can be heard in nearly everything the Danbury, Connecticut native wrote, from the hundreds of rather conventional art songs to his still radical piano sonatas and symphonies. On January 17th, in a Duke Performances concert at Baldwin Auditorium, violinist Stephen Jacque and pianist Jeremy Denk will show how that history animates Ives' rarely performed violin sonatas. Written in fits and starts over the first 15 years of the 20th century, these four sonatas are a solid introduction to Ives' musical language. His music has earned a reputation for density and complexity. His pieces are full of blocky, dissonant harmonies, lines moving in different tempos or meters, multiple keys occurring simultaneously, and a sometimes impenetrable amount of activity. The adjectives craggy, flinty, and granite-like get thrown around. Jacque, who's only played one piece by Ives before starting this project in 2015, learned all four sonatas simultaneously. "It was a really immersive experience," he says. "It was like learning another language because I had spent my entire life playing kind of refined art music, and Ives' music is totally reminiscent of the unschooled earnestness of community music, specifically in New England." Part of that complexity comes from the way Ives constructs these pieces. In the more traditional classical forms, like a sonata, a piece begins by presenting a few themes before exploring how those themes can evolve and interact. Ives takes a decidedly different approach in these sonatas. While each does have a few main themes that draw on these childhood songs, each movement begins with all the variations, digressions, explorations, dissections, and manipulations of those themes. Sometimes bits of the theme or related tunes flash by, only to be subsumed into his continued ruminations. Only at the very end, after he's done everything he can think of, and then some, to his material, does he present the theme in its original, unadulterated form, and only then does the preceding music snap into place as a unified, if somewhat fuzzy, whole. At Baldwin, to help modern audiences recognize some of the now-forgotten source material, the vocal group New York Polyphony will sing the most important hymns for each sonata as Ives would have known them. The effect can be ecstatic. Denk singles out the finale of the first sonata, which transforms the hymn Work for the Night is Coming into what he calls a rambling and endlessly regenerating march. After 7 relentlessly tumbling minutes, the pianist concludes with a short gospel cadence whose meaning has been entirely transfigured. The chaos of Ives's world laid the stage for this one quiet cadence to speak and to feel new, Denk writes. For Jaku, the third sonata, the longest of the set, contains such a movement. The entire sonata is based on the hymn, I Need Thee Every Hour. And each movement has a complicated, cyclical form in which the hymn assumes numerous guises. Ives' harmonic language is slightly less dissonant than usual, but his structures are no less labyrinthines. Nonetheless, when the hymn appears, unadulterated at the end, Jaku feels overwhelmed by the breathtaking shock of beauty that wipes out the preceding chaos. Oh, now I hear our musical group has signed in once again, this time to help me close this reading of Indie Week for January 15th. After this initial airing, you can find this on the NCRS website as a podcast. North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, presents Indie Week for a blind and print-impaired audience. John Federson wishes you all well. Take us on out, Maestro.